This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan. When discussing Malaysian politics, there is a tendency by many to look at the Malays as a singular bloc. On the one hand, there is a penchant by some to blame, quote-unquote, the Malays for our nation's 99 problems. On the other hand, Malay political elites tend to propagate a narrative in which the Malays were united across racial lines once upon a time, and so there is a need to reunite the Malays across racial lines once more. But are the Malays a monolith? Have they ever been? Joining me on the show today to discuss this is Azif Azuddin. He's a political researcher. He also recently penned an essay for Malaysia Kini titled The Myth of Malay Ideological Unity. As always, this conversation is also available as a podcast. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Azif, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you, Darshan.
I guess we can start with an overview. Are the Malays a monolith?
I think the simple answer to that really is that they aren't. Mm-hmm. I think we need to acknowledge that communities, the Malay community, and I think this extends as well to other communities, right? Whether it's the Chinese or the Indians otherwise, they are not a monolith. Communities are made up of different types of individuals, but this also means they are made up of different types of ideologies. The difference now then, I think, is whether our political system rewards monolith approaches, right? Which, as you can see, during the Barisan National Era, it rewards UMNO, it rewarded MCA and MIC for presenting certain communities as monoliths because it is easier to manage larger communities that way.
We will talk about political system, how we can change the political system a little bit later on. But can you first provide an overview of the historical diversity in Malay political ideology? Let's start in pre-independence Malaya.
Yeah, so I think the best place to start really is to draw that line before independence in 1957 and after independence in 1957. Mm-hmm. So before 1957, I think to contextualize Tanah Melayu or Malaya, right, the Malayan lands, is to recognize that there were multiple leftist groups. And I think if you look at the broader regional context of that time in the 1940s, we had the Asian Cold War happening, right? So if we think about our global history, there was a Cold War around that time happening between America or the Western states that were backing democratic values or at least democratic systems versus states, nation states that were pushing for an idea of a more communist, a communist system of governance. So That was the context surrounding Southeast Asia, Malaya, or at least the world at time, right? Malaya of that time was also part of that. So we saw a lot of leftist groups, Malay leftist groups kind of cropping up in Malaysia's, in Malaya of that time. So for example, we had Kesatu Melayu Muda, we had Parti Kebangsaan Melayu Malaya, Pemuda Radikal, Pusat Tenaga Rakyat, which is also called PUTRA, Parti Komunis Malaya, of course, which is notoriously known, but they also, at that point, carried sort of leftist working class values, but of course, integrated violence into its approach, right? But what you naturally saw, I think, of that time was that we also have to contextualize it within the Malay demographic. Majority of the Malays of that time were basically the working class. They were farmers, they were in agriculture and food security, right? So they were farmers, they were fishermen. So it was natural then that the communist ideals, I think, which pushed for working class unity, I think appealed a lot to them. And that's why you saw a lot of leftist parties. But it wasn't until 1946 was it, when the Malay Union was proposed, was, I think at that point, we saw UMNO emerging, right? UMNO emerged as a response to the Malay Union. And I think the rest is history. We know what UMNO did. UMNO protested enough so that the Malay Union was dissolved. But then they became the major political party or major organization that was that worked together with the British administration of that time to form government and kind of pave the path to 1957 independence. So what we saw during that period then, between leading up to independence, we had the Malayan emergency. A lot of this, I think, we can attribute to Parti Komunis Malaya because they used violent approaches, the British administration then decided that, you know, we need to have equally stringent measures. So, you know, that's when we saw a lot of clampdowns of leftist groups, which were left at that point anyway, was associated with being communists then being associated with violent methods of revolution, or violent methods of reorganizing political systems. So around that time, we saw a lot of leftist groups, being dissolved, being banned, outlawed, which is one way that the British administration used to clamp down on workers' movements. So what you saw then emerging from that was that UMNO then became the political party to unite the Malays because they were collaborating with the British government of that time to form a cohesive Tanah Melayu, or Malayan state.
Right. I think you bring up a lot of points to unpack there, but this might be a bit of a tangent, but I think perhaps it's important to clarify as we discuss this topic further, because we are talking a lot about ideology, difference in political opinion, and so on and so forth. Why did you categorize the period of Cold War between the democratic forces and the communist forces rather than capitalist forces versus the communist forces, or capitalist imperialist forces of the global north versus perhaps left, broad left-wing forces led by communists of the global south?
Yeah, so I'm trying to contextualize my understanding of that of Malaya in the period of the ideology of that time, right? So yes, around that time, because it was pushed by Western forces, it was, of course, driven by imperial ideology. It was, of course, also pushed by capitalist ideology. But at that time, I think the economic system wasn't really solidified as we understand it now, right? I think in hindsight, it's easier to categorize, this was a capitalist economic system. This was a communist capitalist system. So of that, if you contextualize it of that time, that wasn't really how they approached it. So if you look at, if you think about how the Malay parties of that time were thinking about economics, they weren't talking about how you organize the economy. They were talking a lot about how you organize people and the systems. So that's why when we see what the People's Constitutional Proposal for Malaya was, they didn't really talk so much about economics. They talked more about how do we organize a post-independence Malaysia by its people, right? So then they talk about how do we categorize Malays, how do you categorize Malaysians of that time, but less on the economic system. So in hindsight, it's easier to say that, this was driven by a capitalist ideology, or this was driven by an economic communist ideology. But at that time, the economic organization wasn't really, I think, the focus of the parties of that time. So, but of course, in the broader global context, yes, there were these economic and ideological systems were present in how the Western imperial systems operated, but also in how the communist nation states such as China, Vietnam, Cambodia, I think of that time were also pushing back. But certainly, no, you have a point there. Yeah.
So you brought up, you know, the existence of left-wing parties such as Kesatuan Melayu Muda, Parti Kebangsaan Melayu Malaya. You know, at that time, we also had Islamic parties such as PAS, but very much different. You know, the PAS under Burhanuddin Al-Helmi is very much different from the PAS of today. But I'm wondering, you know, the existence of these left-wing parties, Islamic parties, and so on and so forth, what does it teach us about the diversity among Malays at the time?
Yeah, I think it tells us a lot about how at that point Malays are, and I think I need to also stress that it is also present today, right? Malays are actually politically diverse.
Right.
They're also politically flexible. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the fact that Malay leftist parties exist, means that there is an appetite for an ideology that was pushing for the working class, that were pushing for equality among equals in society. But also because on the flip side, you also had UMNO, right, which was elite managed. But that also told you that in Malay society, there was also groups of people who were happy to defer governance to the elite, whether it be the royal institution or whether it was elected representatives who came among elite families. So in that sense, I think this is why I stress, right, that Malay society is not a monolith. We have the tendency to kind of think about that nowadays because of decades of UMNO being in power. But if you look at history, it tells us a lot that the Malays are politically diverse. The Malays can ideologically imagine a political future that is leftist, that is socialist in nature, but also at the same time maybe authoritarian if you look at UMNO, right, for example, or capitalist if you look at UMNO as well. In PKR, we saw socialist democratic ideals as well in the 90s. We also have to ask ourselves, why do we have certain groups of Malays who are willing to join the AP despite the negative perception that the AP has, right? That also means that they subscribe to an ideology beyond the what we believe is conservative, capitalist, or authoritarian modes of governing that UMNO has presented to us all these many decades ago. So yeah, I mean, or even Islamists, sorry, but I forgot to talk about Islamists, right? PAS is a very clear example. If you look at PAS roots, PAS actually is leftist in its origins.
Absolutely.
It is leftist, right?
Right.
Yeah, and people forget that PAS is leftist, but also it is Islamist because it sees the political goal of achieving equality through an Islamic system of governance, which if we saw in Iran, they tried to do the same thing. Of course, PAS in its later years, after they reorganized themselves, they adopted the a more theocratic approach. But PAS in its origins are very Islamist plus socialist. So it tells you a lot that Malays were politically diverse. They could imagine political futures and political systems beyond what we box them into now. And I think it's latent. You still have that in society. Yeah.
What role did colonialism play in shaping the concept of Malay identity and Malay unity?
Yeah, so I think if we study post-colonial theory, what we understand is how some processes of independence, especially those that were in collaboration with their colonial administrators, a lot of it then was a negotiation between the British administration feeling like there's a sort of guilt going on, right? So the British administration felt that, look, there were past wrongs that need to be corrected. When it came to the Malays, we deprived them of economic mobility in the many hundreds of years that we colonized them, or were the administrators, right? So let's correct that in the constitution. So that's why we see in the constitution a lot of the provisions that were provided for Bumiputras or the Malays are really correctional measures done by the British, whether it's out of guilt or whether it's out of negotiation with the elites. But otherwise, it was a correctional measure. But then what we also saw, the problem, I think, with that sort of approach, which is very different from Indonesia, right, is that you had the colonial administrators collaborated with the elites. And I think, as we can imagine, the elites are not really rooted on the ground. The elites cannot be said to fully represent the views of the working class or the common man or the common Malay. At that time, I imagine the only reason why UMNO had the support it did among Malay community was, one, because it was also kind of allowed by the British administration. Like, you can imagine, UMNO was constituted mainly of the Malay elites, many of them who were studying in Singapore or the UK, right? So they had familiarity with the British system. They were more willing to concede to the British system of administration and governance. I think if we look at the history of MCKK, I mean, I could be wrong here, but MCKK was also a way how you train future administrators, right? Future people who are supposed to be representatives and political administrators of the country. So you can imagine that that as part of the colonial system, you set up an infrastructure that would allow a generation of Malays or a generation of elites to basically organize themselves in a certain way that the British would have wanted you to organize themselves, which is vastly different than, say, Indonesia, where you saw an uprising and a revolution against their colonial masters, right? It was a bloodbath. But what you had then was a system where orang Indonesia were able to decide for themselves what they wanted to be as Indonesians, right? Instead of negotiating with a colonial body deciding that, hey, this is how Indonesia should look like, right, in concert with, you know, it wasn't decided by the colonial masters. For the Malaysia, the elites colluded, discussed, negotiated with the British to form an idea of how Malaysia should look like in the mold of the British, which is why we have a constitutional system now that is being heavily debated and contested by right-wing groups, right? They're saying that, hey, why are we adopting and why are we carrying on a colonial laws? These are something from the British. This isn't Malaysian, quote-unquote. This isn't Malay. I mean, that raises then a lot of polemics that we have. Our history raises a lot of polemics that we have currently now, yeah.
All right, let's go for a very quick break. On the show with me today is Azif Azuddin. He's a political researcher. We'll continue this conversation after these messages. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Building Fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the show with me today is Azif Azuddin. He's a political researcher, and we are talking about the Malays. Are they a monolith, or are they ideologically diverse? You'll also get to listen to this conversation and others like it via podcast. Just look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. So, Azif, this might sound like a basic question, but I personally think it could have a more interesting answer. What is a Malay?
Well, if you ask a social theorist, mm-hmm. a sociologist as I am, it's a social construct.
Right.
Right? I mean, if you ask people what Malays mean in different contexts, whether it's legally, socially, constitutionally, you have very different answers. The constitution may define Malay as somebody who practices Malay tradition and is Muslim. And that's separate from Bumiputra, yeah? Which includes Sabah, Sarawak, and indigenous peoples. But if you ask somebody, if you ask a right-wing individual what is a Malay, then they would immediately tell you that, you know, it's someone who practices Islam. It's somebody who practices the Malay tradition in a very specific manner. You have to wear the tanjak, baju Melayu every Friday. There is a sort of marker as to what defines you as a Malay when you ask the right person. But then if you ask a cosmopolitan Malay, right? Somebody like Farish Noh has written something about the Malay culture via historical research, right? And he talks a lot about how Malays are cosmopolitan. So he uses Hang Tuah as an example of how there's this one quote, right, which we all, which most people know at this point, which is called Takkan Melayu Hilang di Dunia. So most right-wing group or conservative groups would say that as, you know, Malays will always be present in the world, or and that kind of justifies the hegemony, right? But if you ask somebody like Farish Noh interprets Takkan Melayu Hilang di Dunia as Malays who are cosmopolitan, Malays who are global, worldly. So if you think about how he wrote about Hang Tuah actually after killing Jebat, He went abroad. He went to different countries. He went to different sovereign states to meet their rulers. And in that, he showed that Malays can be broad. Malays can be open-minded. Open-minded in the sense where they're cosmopolitan. They can accept other cultures. They can integrate and naturally adapt to other cultures. So, I mean, it really depends who you ask. Even for me myself, I don't have a clear answer as to what a Malay means, because at the end of the day, it's a social construct. It is defined by what the majority defines it as, but it also allows, I think there should also be allowance for redefining what Malay means according to the times, according to what society feels it should be, also according to what minority groups believe Malays should also be, right? I mean, those who maybe don't subscribe to the larger idea of what right-wingers think Malay is, or what the constitution thinks Malays should be. Keep in mind, constitution is a living document. In theory, we could actually amend it to mean what Malays should mean, right?
Right. And that, you know, the point about constitution is particularly important, I think. And it ties to this next question, right? And that is, how has the definition of Malay evolved over time? Because the two constitutions that were in contention pre-independence, the People's Constitution, which was proposed by the broad left, and the constitution brought about by the elites, which is the constitution which we have today, had two very different ideas of what being Malay meant. How do you contextualize that?
Yeah, so we talked a lot, I think, earlier about how when the constitution was put together, in negotiation between the British and also Barisan Nasional, or at least the Alliance of that time, right? That's what they call it, the Alliance of that time.
Right.
A lot of the elites, I think a lot of the discussion or consideration taken to the elites and also the British administration was like, what are the correctional measures that should we put in place inside the constitution, right? And that's why you saw Malays being defined narrowly, right? Because if you see this in opposition to the people's constitutional proposals for Malaya, which was proposed by the All Malaya Council of Joint Action, which is, as you said, the broad left. Their definition of Malay, however, is vastly different. For the People's Constitution, Malays were actually took on a form, the definition of Malays took on a form which is closer to Indonesia, which is that everyone in the country, everyone in that nation state would be considered Malays.
So it's so how we imagine the term Bangsa Malaysia today.
Correct. Right. Yeah, it's how we imagine the term Bangsa Malaysia today. Although, to kind of fine-tune that a little bit, Bangsa right. Malaysia implies a Malaysian race. I mean, a Malaysian polity, right? What does that even mean, right? Diversity in, I mean, it could mean diversity in how we imagine our communities and whatnot. But I think I would imagine that the Malays, as defined by then the People's Constitution, I think is more broader, broadly ties in closer to what Indonesia looks like now, right? Which is that you have a general idea of what it is to be Indonesian. Everyone speaks Indonesian. Everyone has Indonesian names, regardless of what race you are. But there is diversity in the little different ways how your communities operate, function, practice tradition. But there is still an adherence to this idea of what does it mean to be Malay? Compared to what we have now, right, with the constitution, or even Bangsa Malaysia. I think Bangsa Malaysia, I think, adopts a more American approach, which is a more broader, you can be American, but you can also have your diasporas.
Right.
But you respect everyone's little diasporas and ways of governing or schooling or educating themselves, right? So there is no adherence, I think, to a solid idea. I think Bangsa Malaysia, to me, when people talk about Bangsa Malaysia, it feels a little bit more American in that sense, right?
Right.
Where it's like, it's just a broad term that you just stick to anything and anything goes. It's just that everyone calls themselves Malaysian.
Right.
Versus what the People's Constitution proposal was giving, which was closer to what the idea of an Indonesian polity looks like, which is that there are certain landmarks or certain markers of what it meant or looked meant like to be an Indonesian. Versus what we have now with the constitution, which is that if you are Malay, you need to be Muslim, you need to practice Malay tradition, whatever that means. And of course, indigenous or asal then are kind of excluded from the very narrow definition of Malay lah. But at the end of the day, because it was negotiated with the elites, right? The elites were also, I think, thinking in terms, broadly politically thinking in terms of like, okay, how do we write the constitution in a way that that ensures that power is concentrated into a very narrow definition of Malays that also applies to them? How do we also protect and safeguard the royal constitution? That was also present, by the way, in the People's Constitution. And I think what we saw with the definition set up for Malays of Bumiputra when 1957 came about also led then to the NEP, right? Because the NEP then, what NEP did was that it looked at the constitution and then, you know what? From the constitution, from that one provision, we can then draw up policies that tie in to that one definition of what Malay means.
Right.
So we can see the reverberating effect of decisions made in the past and how in defining a certain people, how that has long-term effects down the road, decades on.
So what are those long-term effects and how did the independence period and the post-independence period of Malaya and then later Malaysia, how did the political landscape evolve, especially when it comes to Malay politics?
Yeah, so thanks to the Malayan Emergency, which lasted well after independence, right? So Malayan Emergency was between 48 to 60.
Right.
We achieved independence in 57. So we actually achieved independence during a period when we were still actively fighting against Parti Komunis Malaya. So what we saw through the emergency was also a consolidation of power, right? So because UMNO, Barisan Nasional, were the main collaborators with the British, they were obviously given the mandate and I think the political support to also define and guide what Malayness or the Malay polity looks like. And I think we saw this decades on happening, and we saw this decades after, right? Which is that even though to thread the origin of PAS, right? PAS originally emerged from Hizbul Muslimin. So Hizbul Muslimin is kind of like a branch of UMNO that decided to be more Islam, that believed that Malaysia should have more Islamic elements, the Malays should have more Islamic elements in political values. Hizbul Muslimin eventually evolved to PAS, early PAS, which is still socialist. After they reorganized themselves, then they became more Islamist and theological in their approach.
Right.
But I digress. But regardless, UMNO of that time, because they were given the hegemonic tools to manage how the political landscape looks like. That's why you saw, I think, a lot of clampdown onto enemies, to their political enemies, right? I mean, if you look at past, it's a very good example. The Mahathir era, I think, is very notorious, I think, for using very authoritarian, draconian measures to stifle political dissent. I mentioned Al-Arqam. If people are not aware of Al-Arqam, Al-Arqam actually was an Islamic sect that was gaining economic and political influence. And they're just based in Sungai Pencala. That's right near to the BFM office, right?
Right.
They had a small community, but very influential community that was showing how you can organize yourself economically, you can organize yourself politically, independent of UMNO. And Mahathir, that time, felt so threatened by this rising group that, you know, he outrightly banned Al-Arqam. He captured the leader. That was one instance. Or if you think about Mamali, right? The Mamali incident in the 50s. So Mahathir claimed that he wasn't in the country when that happened. But what happened was essentially in the Mamali group, there was an uprising against UMNO of that time because they were dissatisfied with how UMNO were doing things, especially against PAS. So what happened that time? More than 100 villagers were either killed or violently attacked by the police, by the state, right? And that cemented, I think, that cements and tells us at least that of that time, there was a concentrated effort by UMNO to stifle its political enemies in order to maintain hegemony over what one, Malayness could be interpreted as so, and two, to not allow any different interpretations of what Malay power could look like, right? PAS, of course, have shown that we have an alternative to that. They proved that definitely in the last elections that Malay power could, you know, be redefined more broadly beyond what UMNO has set out for the past 60 years, right?
Right.
But of course, we saw after Reformasi in 1999, we saw Malay ideology break into a more socialist democratic approach. Right? I mean, we can't say that PKR is fully socialist lah, but at least at the time of conception, there was this idea that Malay ideology was able to reimagine itself into a more progressive, more justice-driven approach than what UMNO had set out for the past 50 years prior to that. So, yeah, I mean, UMNO had tried for up to 2018, tried to maintain political power, tried to define what Malayness looks like, what Malay Muslimness looks like, and they failed, right? Because I think we can attribute that to technology, we can attribute that to social media or how people think about political systems based on the information that they get from abroad, or even how they organize themselves from within. And a lot of that I attribute to technology lah.
Before we dive deeper into the Reformasi era, I think in that period, right, where you talk about this UMNO hegemony from the period of independence until 2018, there were massive historical monumental moments that happened in that period that even within the hegemony, there was reshaping, there was so many different political movements. And I think a significant period was in, you know, 1969, we're talking about the May 13, you know, racial riots, and then the subsequent crafting and implementation of the new economic policy. I'm wondering how did these events shape Malay politics and also broader Malaysian politics?
So with regards to May 13 and the NDP, I think the effects of that, I mean, we'll talk about the effects first, then we can kind of backtrack a little bit. But when we talk about the effects, what the NDP was essentially able to do, what May 13 was able to do was legitimize UMNO or Barisan Nasional, narrowing down economic policies or narrowing down socioeconomic policies and approaches to be more Malay-Muslim-centric like at that time. It became Muslim a bit after. So, I mean, but if you talk about what led up to it, right? I mean, if you talk about post-independence, of course, a lot of leftist groups were already outlawed, banned, or, you know, has assimilated to other smaller groups, or even some of them have joined UMNO. So if you think about that period where there really wasn't really a strong opposition, then that's where we saw more racialized movements. Right? So May 13 essentially really was a racial conflict between DAP, MCA, and some other Chinese parties at that time, and also against the Malays. And I think it needs to be acknowledged that I think there was an antagonistic relationship between the Chinese and the Malays of that time. The Malays felt economically disenfranchised. The Chinese felt that the Malays do not deserve economic or political power. At that time, yeah, I'm very sure the AP holds a very different view now, many decades after. But and that was the source. That really was the source of Malay. That really was the source of this racial conflict. And I think what necessitated NAP was Tun Razak looking at the situation and thinking that, you know what, the corrective measures implemented in the constitution by the British were not enough. We need an economic policy to reorganize Malay society to be more economically developed, so that we can reduce any feelings of ill will or contempt against non-Malays who are economically more advanced or economically more developed than the Malay community, who are at that time, to be fair, was still mostly part of the working class, was still living in rural areas and part of the food security industry, and not really engaging in more industrial, quote-unquote, industrial economies like manufacturing or what do you call it, or mining and whatnot, right? Which the Chinese naturally were at that time due to how the British organized us.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that was the context surrounding NAP. And NAP, I felt gave justification for UMNO and Barisan Nasional to more narrowly define and cement hegemony. Because if you control the means of supply and demand, if you control resources that can be given to a community, you also have power over them. And I think that was what the NAP also essentially did, which is why you end up hearing derogatory remarks given to the Malays, right? Oh, kau perlukan tongkat, tongkat meaning assistance, right? And a lot of that then stems from feelings of dissatisfaction against what the NAP has resulted in, right? Which is that Malays rely so much on government, they rely so much on government help, which was the result of the NAP, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I see. First follow up from what you just said is that, would it be fair to broadly contextualize, just jumping piggyback off your point that you brought up of the May 13, as that the Malays were economically ostracized and the Chinese were politically ostracized, which then, of course, due to various other factors as well, brought about May 13. And when it comes to the NAP, right, even that and the perceptions towards that has evolved over time, right? Because I think a lot of people, especially if from the, whether it's non-Malays or even the Malays, tend to forget that the NAP was actually seen as a positive, affirmative action required to build a more egalitarian, equitable society, because there was a lack of the Malay middle class. When we look at the professionals at the time, whether it's teachers, lawyers, doctors, it was mainly dominated by non-Malays. Obviously, there was, of course, mm-hmm. non-Malay poor and non-Malay laborers and all of that. But when we look at the professional class, it was mainly non-Malay. So this was a necessary sort of affirmative action put forth by a self-described Fabian socialist, Tun Razak, to build a more egalitarian society. It's just that over time, took on a rather ethno-nationalist approach of, let's say, Ketuanan Melayu, or perhaps it was abused by the elites.
Yeah, so I think you're right in saying that there was a lot of support for the NAP, because I think we also had to acknowledge that at that point, everyone was in consensus that there were economic disparities between the Malays and the non-Malays. So when the NAP was introduced as an affirmative action and corrective measure, it was widely supported by pretty much everyone, right? Because there was an acknowledgement of that. But I think the problem, as you said earlier, is that the thing about systems, right? The thing about policies is that there needs to be a revision of the policies every 5 to 10 years or so, right? Because policy changes we have to take account that situation changes over time, right? Mm. The landscape changes over time. The problem with NAP was that there was never a revision of whether the NAP was still relevant, or more reasons were given as to why the NAP should be continued to be maintained. And a lot of that then was decided by UMNO, right? Mm. I mean, let's be real, right? I mean, there are a lot of news reports talking about how there are issues of corruption, there are issues of contracts being given to other people with no due process and whatnot. And a lot of that really then is the abuse of the NAP, right? The NAP, which was intended with good... which was created with good intentions, but eventually, because it was eventually abused by the elite. So yeah, I completely agree with the assessment, right? That what was a good policy in the first place was, one, never revised, but two, was also abused by those who took advantage of it most, which is why you see, even in Malay society now, there's a lot of discontent among the Malay average person saying that, hey, you know what? Even though there's the NAP, even though there's Malay economic policies, I'm not benefiting from it. You know, where is it coming to me? I go to Mara, and Mara rejects my application all the time. Who's getting all these grants? Who's getting all this money? Right. So there is a very real perception that the NAP is not working for the average Malay. And I think that needs to be impressed upon as well, right? Because I think a lot of non-Malays have this perception that the NAP is benefiting, the NAP or Malay economic policies have been benefiting the average Malay. But in my research, a lot of the Malays I met and interviewed have felt that we don't even reap the fruits. A lot of it goes to people who are politically connected, or people who know other people in power, or people who know how to get past certain doors, right? So yeah, I mean, a revision is badly needed. And I think Najib tried to, during Najib era, he tried to reorganize that, but I don't think it was done in a way that was done well, put it simply.
Let's go for one more break. On the show with me today is Azif Azuddin. He's a political researcher. We'll continue the last part of this conversation after these messages. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Building Fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Azif Azuddin. He's a political researcher, and we are talking about the Malays. I'm asking him if the Malays are a monolith or are they ideologically diverse? So, Azif, you know, I think a significant period which you touched on earlier is that really brought about seismic changes in the modern political conversation, political landscape, is the late 90s, the beginning of the Reformasi era. How did that, shape contemporary Malay politics, particularly in terms of ideological shifts and party alignments?
So I think we need to recognize first and foremost that Reformasi was born out of what happened to one single person.
Right.
We need to acknowledge that. So the genesis of Reformasi really was an injustice against one person. Yeah. But it evolved. I think the injustice of it reverberated and was identified by the rest of the Malay population so much because they were disgusted by it, because they were horrified by what was done to Dato' Sri Anwar of that time, that they connected. So right. That's why at that point, Reformasi saw a lot of people marching in KL, a lot of people identifying with Reformasi, because at that point in Malay society, there was this red line that was drawn and saying, you know what, that's not how we do things. That's not how Malays react. Because if you remember what Mahathir did at that time, a lot of the things that he did to Anwar, but also towards Anwar supporters, were considered, you know, close to evil, right? Like he literally paraded around the mattress in which allegedly the act was committed, right?
Right.
Around the country. And Malay society were disgusted by it. They say, why do we even do... I mean, is this how Malays conduct themselves? Is this how Malay power looks like? So I think Reformasi had a lot of traction among the average Malays, or urban Malays at least at the time, because there was this feeling that UMNO has outlived what they were preaching for equality among equals or justice and whatnot. So when Reformasi came about, it became an avenue, I think, for a more progressive Malay ideology to emerge, right? Even though PKR is multicultural, but we saw a lot of UMNO, members, Saifuddin Nasution, for example, as well, right? Breaking right. away from UMNO and then moving into PKR because they felt like, you know what, UMNO has lost its way. We need a new way of imagining Malay power, Malay ideology that is more progressive, that is more inclusive, that holds on to more progressive values, which is why then we saw Reformasi, I felt, was a period that broke the Malay hegemony that UMNO had. And of course, over the many years after that, over the decades after that, it was really chipping away. It was really about slowly chipping away at UMNO's hold over Malay, over the Malay polity, right? And we saw that successfully happen in 2018. We see now the lines are more clearly drawn between people who support Pakatan Harapan Malays who support Pakatan Harapan, but also Malays who support PAS, Malays who also still somewhat support UMNO. So we see now a fragmentation, but also a diverse landscape that tells us that, you know what, Malay ideology has evolved. Malay ideology has the potential to evolve. And I think people need to remember that.
Where are we today, Azif? And do you think this obsession by political elites today to, quote-unquote, unite the Malays across racial lines? And because I think uniting anything, right, uniting people is a good thing. But the framing of it is uniting a people across racial lines. Do you think this speaks to a larger problem with the highly racialized Malaysian politics as a whole? Because it's not just the Malays. If we look at the way all our the various ethnic groups vote, it tends to be across racial lines. If we look at the results of GE15, and it clearly shows that, you know, I think a good 90%+ of non-Malays support Pakatan Harapan, and vice versa, you are looking at maybe a good 80% of plus, you know, 80-85% on a national level that don't support Pakatan Harapan, that swings towards Perikatan Nasional perhaps. And in the ways, it's not just the Malays, right? In our conversations with non-Malays and so on and so forth, you see that tendency for everyone to look at politics and each other through a racialized prism. How does this tie into why there is this quote-unquote obsession or narratives by the elites to unite the Malays under a sort of racial line?
Oh, for sure. I mean, but I need to correct you on that, right? Because I think the pushing for a Malay polity or Malay unity is not necessarily pushed by the elites. Because I think the elites have, I think we need to fine-tune this a bit, because based on my research, is that the elites have interest to maintain Malay polity because, political power and the sort of benefits that come with it, right? Mm. But if you look at right-wing groups who are really made up of average working-class Malays, they are pushing for the idea of a Malay polity because of this fear that their real or imagined rights or benefits or way of living is being chipped away, right? So if we see post-2018, right-wing groups like Pembela, ISMA, Umar, among many others, were anxious, and the agitated society, the agitated Malay anxiety, because they felt that, oh no, UMNO, who has been the bastion of Malay unity, lost in the elections. What does this mean then for Malay society? If Malay society is fragmented, if Malay ideology is fragmented, then where can we, orang kata, menaruh harapan? Or where can we then seek ways of maintaining what is seen as a Malay polity lah, or Malay power or Malay economic hold onto society, right?
Right.
So the anxiety, I think, is what leads to where we have what we have now. A lot of skirmishes, a lot of narrative disinformation, a lot of hate speech surrounding Malays, non-Malays, and a lot of it really is part of a larger discourse on putting back Malay power onto a single platform as it used to be. And I think that's an impossible task, to be honest, because I think we fragmented beyond that point already. But what we saw, I think, post-2018 as well, is this marriage between nationalist ideals, which is represented by UMNO, and also Islamist ideals by PAS. And there was an opportunity in finding a collaboration because there was a political necessity to do so, right? But I also need to kind of bring up, right, this fact that while there's a lot of talk around Malay polity, Malay unity, right, a single Malay entity that governs or takes care of the rights of the Malays, there is also this perception that non-Malays, or to be more specific, the Chinese community, would not vote anyone else but the AP.
Right.
Which is the flip side of it, right? That can the Chinese community also, is the Chinese community, because of political necessity, do they then not have the opportunities to kind of break away? Because Malay, I don't believe the Chinese are a monolith.
Absolutely.
I believe they are politically diverse, but because of the political situation, because they need to survive politically, the AP is the only one that can kind of maintain any sense of political foothold to represent their voices. And I think that's where we can see a flip side. And I think we need to see that in concert as well, right? Why is that called Malay polity? Why is that called Malay unity? For the same reasons why the Chinese community are more than willing, if not most of them, are more than willing to vote DAP, as well, and not in any party.
Right. I think you bring up an excellent point. And yes, this conversation today is about the Malays and the ideological diversity among the Malays. But it's the same across racial lines, right? The Chinese are ideologically diverse. The Indians are ideologically diverse. The Orang Asli, Sabah Sarawak and Orang Asal, they are all ideologically diverse. It's just that the system tends to force people, force political parties and people to think across racial lines for their survival. So with that in mind, looking ahead, how do you envision the future of Malay politics in Malaysia? And where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think this is why institutional reform is so key. Mm-hmm. Institutional and political reform is so key in reorganizing society and how we think about how we organize ourselves, right? Dr. Wong Chin Huat, I think, has this thinking that I subscribe to as well, right? Which is that political parties will react in ways that rewards them. Mm-hmm. So if we have an institution that rewards racial politics, political parties will also react in ways that fit to that mold, right? So, I mean, then this, we need an all of society approach in that sense, right? We need to have civil society to push for maybe a different electoral system that doesn't reward winner takes all. Because the reason why UMNO had so much hegemony, or why certain political parties win, or why certain race political parties win in the elections, and why people think of politics in that way, is also because we have a winner takes all approach. Anyone who wins 2/3 of parliamentary seats becomes those in power. So that means it's a numbers game, right?
Right.
But if you have a numbers game, that then limits any possibilities for diversity, because everyone has to kind of adhere to very either specific ideologies or negotiate in very specific terms what is allowed politically and what isn't allowed politically. We see that a lot with the sort of limitations that the Madani government is experiencing now, mm-hmm. right? They are constricted in a variety of different ways because they have to adhere to very specific political ideologies or norms in order to maintain power, right? But if we can reimagine a political system, if you can reimagine a system that rewards inclusivity, right, instead of winner takes all, for example, in our electoral system, then that will open ways of thinking about, can we have more diverse political views, not just among the Malays, but also among other communities, right? Can we reorganize ourselves based on ideology instead of race? Can we organize ourselves on our value systems instead of race, as we see in other countries that, you know, don't hinge on so much on race, right?
Right.
Maybe we can have a party that unites based on environmental reasons. Mm-hmm. We can have a party that unites. And I know we have PSM, but unfortunately, PSM... leftist ideology, because it has been hammered so much in society over the past many decades, right? People don't really believe in socialist ideals so much.
Or at least the socialist branding.
Or the branding, right? It could be right. Branding as well. Right. I think there's a resurgence of socialist ideals elsewhere in the world. Malaysia, not so much, because I think we're still tied to communism.
Right.
If we can reorganize, first of all, our electoral system, I think that will pave way a lot to broadening how we imagine ourselves ideologically as a society. Yeah.
I think that's a very good place to end this conversation, Azif. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to Azif Azuddin. He's a political researcher. And this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.